show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, end of the season edition, folks. We actually don't have Royals baseball to talk to you about, at least in terms of live games, but we have plenty of stuff to recap from the season that was. So before we get to that, introductions, of course, I am Jeff Herr, and with me, as always, is the man who never has an off season, Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this very fall Midwestern evening?
Well, I think I'm having a better day than Jason Lockenfora, that's for sure.
Oh, not hard, but okay.
Oh, boy. That's it's a little bit rough of a night from last night, it looked like. So
these things tend to happen. You know, when you one thing's for certain, when you are a D-bag on Twitter, karma always comes back around to get you. So, you know, as if the sweep in the ALCS in the 2014 was not enough, we had for the Orioles, it was a horrible game. But so I saw someone say, actually before last night's game between the Blue Jays and the Orioles, that since the wild card game, the extra game has been established in Major League Baseball, there have been 8 games. And you had one classic, Royals, mm-hmm. Royals A's in 2014, and 7 essential duds.
Yeah.
So last night, thanks to last night, you can add another one into the classic category. Maybe not necessarily. It wasn't quite as good as the Royals A's game. I didn't watch the whole. I didn't watch the. I wasn't able to watch it, but I was able to kind of get the recap of what happened. And you had the Baltimore Orioles, Toronto Blue Jays tied into the 11th inning. Zach Britton, one of the best pitchers in baseball, left in the bullpen by the chess master himself, Buck Showalter. And the resulting karma for that poor decision was a walk-off home run by Edwin Encarnacion. And now the Blue Jays are on to have a rematch with the Texas Rangers from last year's ALDS, in which the Blue Jays famously came back from being down 2-0 and had another. I don't think that was it wasn't walk off with Jose Bautista's hit, was it? It was just
The big bat flip one. I think it was.
Was it a walk off? Okay, so
I think it was.
So that's 2 years in a row they've had a huge walk off. Yeah. So kind of interesting, Mike. With the besides the glee from the tears of Jason Lockenfora, what what else? What were your thoughts after last night's game?
Well, I mean, it was the cool thing was, you know, you got Baltimore who led the majors in homers and the Blue Jays who had like 3 guys with 35 homers or more. And just, you know, we saw last year how good the Blue Jays were, especially in Toronto and what kind of power they can do. And, you know, to have it go down and be a 2-2 game throughout, that was kind of surprising and kind of satisfying in a way, because, you know, I think it's best when playoff baseball kind of works to that kind of direction. You know, it's you get the kind of feeling that, okay, every plate appearance matters and there's so much going into just, okay, we got to get these outs and stuff. And so throughout the game, there was either tied or within one run through the entirety of it. And you know, you get to this mixing and matching of guys, and, you know, the Orioles have plenty of good relievers. But, yeah, I mean, the thing that's going to stand out is Zach Britton not being used. I mean, this is a guy, what's his ERA, 0.54? I mean, he's
given, I think it was 0.56. So.
Oh, that's so much worse. My mistake. He's, you know, he gave up a run in, like, April.
Yeah, maybe.
He gets still ground balls 80% of the time. He's converted 47 straight save opportunities. I mean, that's incredible. And he threw zero pitches. I just don't know how that happens. And that's going to be the thing that, you know, that game is remembered as. Not necessarily like, you know, Showalter getting a Grady Little moment, because I think he'll be fine. But it's definitely going to be something that, you know, everybody remembers when talking about that game. And, you know, if that's something that propels Toronto into the World Series or something, then, you know, that'll be kind of an iconic little moment. But, you know, someone's got to win. I wasn't sure who I wanted to win. You know, it's neither team is my favorite. And then, of course, when Lock and Fora, you know, I kind of went back and forth on who I was rooting for. I think I started kind of rooting for Baltimore because I just don't like Toronto. And then kind of wanted Toronto to win because, again, I don't like Baltimore. And then when the fan threw the beer into left field at the player, then I was kind of, again, for Baltimore. And I don't know. You know, I'm thankful that one of those teams lost. And that's kind of what it comes down to.
Yes, it's kind of sometimes in college basketball when people, when Duke and North Carolina play each other and it's like, oh, who do you want to win? I'm like, is there any way like the stadium can implode and nobody gets injured, but neither teams win and they actually both lose? That was a similar scenario.
Can we just give the Rangers a bye?
Yeah, but I think you said it best when, you know, if that was going to happen and if it was going to be the Toronto Blue Jays and if there was a person on the Toronto Blue Jays for that to happen to, Edwin Encarnacion is probably the best person for that to happen to. Of the prominent Blue Jays players, he's probably the least annoying.
Yeah, that's the way to put it. I mean, nobody likes Josh Donaldson except Josh Donaldson,
no.
I don't think.
No, no, no.
Bautista, you know, is notable for his antics. And
yes.
Yeah, Tulowitzki, some people have a problem. He just mostly just looks annoying to me, and that's not fair to call him annoying just because he looks annoying, but he does look annoying.
I mean, it is kind of fair. It's fair in my book.
Okay. Then I don't feel bad about it. Speaking of which, Madison Bumgarner's on my TV now, too. So in that vein, tonight's matchup, that's the thing. Like, Leski pointed this out to us because I stared me right in the face. I didn't even notice it. The Royals beat the Orioles and the Blue Jays in the last two American League Championship Series, and then they play in the wild card. And then their last two NL pennant and also Royals World Series opponents are playing in the NL wild card, which is just kind of crazy. And when you also have it being Bumgarner, who was the chief villain of 2014 in a very dominant way, and Noah Syndergaard, who, you know, we all remember Game 3 of the World Series last year. It's another interesting matchup.
Oh, yes, we do.
Yeah. This one I'm less acrimonious. You know, I don't hate either team. I dislike Syndergaard, but I don't, like, hate him. And I don't hate Bumgarner either. It's just, you know, it just sucks that he, you know, whooped the crap out of the Royals in 2014. Without Baumgartner, they win the World Series. And so, you know, that sticks.
I mean, Syndergaard is at least hateable based on his offenses, you know, throwing at Escobar like he did. And then, you know, some of the comments he made both after the game and then this season, especially with the great American woman controversy of April 2016.
God, almost forgot about that.
And then so those, you know, those are at least hateable offenses in terms of things that he's said and done, whereas Madison Bumgarner seems to be an all-around good dude. It just really sucks that he's so good and not on the Royals, especially for the 2014 World Series.
Bumgarner does have his moments, though. He does end up getting into, you know, some shouting matches with other guys.
He's got some intensity.
Yeah,
so but, you know, I don't mind that from players, you know, as long as, you know, it's just, it's understandable, like, intensity stuff. I've never really heard him say, I don't know. I guess I don't really pay too much attention to the newspaper clippings of the San Francisco Giants that often, but, you know, I don't know that I've heard him make a ton of negative comments about other players from other teams or anything. So.
He gets really kind of antsy when somebody, you know, like he'll make a play that's, you know, maybe good or maybe even just north of routine. And maybe it's in a big moment and he gets kind of amped up and the player, you know, they either take, you know, strong offense or they, you know, kind of roll their eyes or something. And that's kind of when he reacts. So that's kind of what it works out to is, you know, he's maybe that's heat of the moment. Maybe it is a hateable offense too, because it does keep happening. It's, you know, one of those things that Ventura kind of carries with him where he keeps getting into these things and Machado keeps getting involved in things. I don't know, but this should be a pretty intense pitching matchup for sure. So, you know, that's kind of interesting to kind of see what happens, you know, with this kind of matchup. This, you know, after the Orioles and Blue Jays go 2-2 for most of the game or most of the latter part of the game, be interesting to see kind of what happens when, you know, these two guys, maybe this will be like an 8-7 game and defy all expectations, but I don't know. I don't really care who wins this National League game. Everybody assumes the Cubs are going to beat whoever wins this game anyway. The Giants haven't been great down the stretch. The Mets are kind of missing most of their rotation from last year and last postseason. So, you know, I think they're both kind of sitting ducks as far as, you know, those things are concerned. So, you know, don't really care too much, but I think if I had to root, I guess I'd root for the, I don't know. I just can't muster up a preference really.
Yeah. I mean, if gun to my head, as they say, I'd probably say the Giants.
Sure. Fair enough.
Simply, you know, I feel like they've been built similarly to the Royals and their approach is similar to the Royals and, you know, most of the players in their team feel like, I feel like you could see a lot of the Giants players on the Royals as players.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that I could say the same about a lot of the Mets players. Like, I don't know how well Yoenis Cespedes would fit in Royals clubhouse or a Noah Syndergaard or something like that. So, if we're talking arbitrary reasons on why we want to have a rooting interest in a team, that is my nonsensical one. So there it is.
Okay. It's fair enough. That's more reason than I have to even be, indifferent, I guess. So I just, you know, the main thing is it's just kind of weird to have the Royals not involved.
Yes, it is.
It's funny how fast that happened, that you kind of got used to it. It's like the intensity of this month is dialed. Like I was just kind of sitting around messing with my phone in the later moments of that wild card game last night because I had no rooting interest directly. It didn't impact my team. There was no reason for me to be anxious because I didn't have to worry about, you know, if the Royals were going to play either of those teams. It was kind of nice, but also, you miss that feeling. You want to see it again next year, but it's how quickly we become spoiled to those sorts of things. It's weird.
Very much so. Very much so. It is kind of, you know, and it's interesting too, because not only not having to worry about the Royals in the playoffs, but also the kind of residual effect of, now, the last couple of years, especially when it came around to Chiefs season after the Royals finally ended their run, and then that bleeding into KU basketball season, like it was so much harder for me to get up for those sports with the amount of energy and effort you put into being a fan of a team making deep postseason runs. Like, I don't know, when you look at a team, a city like Boston, you know, I mean, I guess they have more people to shoulder the load, if you will.
Sure.
But I mean, I don't know how you can, you know, especially that period of like 01 to 2010. I mean, they're winning championships left and right on their teams. How do they have enough energy to, and hell, and money to support all these teams for all these runs and everything? I mean, it would be exhausting. So, it's kind of interesting now that I can actually kind of have a little bit more pay a little bit more attention earlier to Chiefs season, whether that's good or bad. You know, as of this past week, it's you know, I'd much rather the Royals still be playing, but I guess as we've mentioned, they're not in the playoffs, but we can kind of recap the season. Finally, the Royals finished, I believe, for the first time ever at 500 exactly. Is that right?
I think so. They've been kind of in that range before, but
I think they've had an 80 and 82 season before.
They've had the 83 and 79. They've done that.
Yep. So let's see. They've
in the strike shortened 1981. Yep. They were 50 and 53, so that was pretty close. But yeah, I don't think they'd ever.
Yeah. So 90 and 91, they were 82 and 80. So they haven't been 80 and 82. It was the other way. So they were 82 and 80 in 91, and they were 79 and 83 in 83. Hmm. So those are the closest. They've had 83 wins a couple of times, 77 a couple of times. But so this is the first time they've ever finished 500. So unfortunately, our stat that we were talking about of four straight winning seasons isn't accurate. It'll have to change to be four straight non-losing seasons, as this is the only non-losing and non-winning season in Royals history. So for whatever that's worth, but the Royals finish 81 and 81, had a golden opportunity. They just had to rip off one win to get that fourth consecutive winning season. And they finish the season on a four game losing streak. So
yeah.
Totally unfortunate, but I suppose these things happen. So last year, the Royals set a franchise record, 2.7 million. In attendance this year, not quite that good, but 2.5 million is always good to see them. You know, if you can cross that 2 million mark, especially in a small market like the Royals, you're doing pretty well. And for them to be north of 2.5 million, that's really solid. Can't really complain too much about that.
Yep. And the TV ratings, Fox Sports Kansas City had the best regional baseball ratings again for the second straight year.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people are watching. I mean, even if the Royals only finished 81 and 81, they're still paying attention. They're still around. And I would expect that to carry over to next year. The Royals in their postseason press conference did mention that they kind of budgeted this year with an expectation of playoff games that add revenue. And so, you know, you get that early hand wringing of, oh, well, what are we going to do with payroll and our budget and stuff? But, you know, plenty of time to worry about that kind of stuff. It's just going to be, I think, the same as every other year where they're going to hem and haw and say, well, we don't want to add too much. We can't really add right now. And then they're going to add anyway, because that's the game. That's how it goes. So, but yeah, I think, you know, not a wildly successful year, but there are, you know, considering that you missed multiple All-Stars for weeks and weeks at a time, and many of those absences overlapped, you know, they kind of made it through. They got some contributions from younger players like Chesler Cuthbert and Whit Merrifield and Matt Strom, and you kind of got to see a little bit of Brooks Pounders, and you got a career year from Drew Butera, and, you know, kind of got to see a little bit. Paulo Orlando had a good year. Gerard Dyson had a good year. Danny Duffy had a breakout year. Ian Kennedy was better than expected. You know, those are positives coming out of it. And, you know, most everybody who was hurt this year should be fully healthy next year for the most part. You know, those are things to kind of build on and kind of feel good about, even though 81 and 81 is pretty disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, when you're coming, again, to get that context, you know, a couple of years ago, 81 and 81 would have been fantastic. We would have loved it. But when you're coming off two straight pennants and a World Series championship, 81 and 81 is disappointing, as it should be.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's unfortunate, but these things happen. It's really, really hard to make the playoffs, you know, that many years in a row. It's not something that you see, you know, and David Leske brought up this point to us. You know, you could make the argument that the San Francisco Giants, it may be the best organization in baseball over the last 30 years. And what did he say? 21 winning seasons
in the last 30.
Yeah. Yeah. Was it 30 or I can't remember what was his?
I think it was. That's what I remember off the top of my head.
Was 30. Okay. Yeah. And he had 21 winning seasons. They've won 3 championships. They've been to another World Series. And never have they made the playoffs in back-to-back years in that time span, I should say. You know, so you got like the Yankees, of course, who've done it a lot, and the Red Sox. But the Red Sox have had their downturns. The Yankees have had their off years. You know, the Cardinals missed the playoffs this year, just like the Royals did. And the Giants have done their every other year thing. They're back in the playoffs this year after being out last year, after winning the World Series the year before. And it's really hard to continually make the playoffs in baseball, especially when you've got, you know, from a percentage standpoint, Major League Baseball has the least amount of playoff teams relative to the total. You know, in the NBA, they've got 30 teams also, and 16 make the playoffs. Same for the NHL.
It's crazy. Right?
So more than half of the teams. And the NFL, 32 teams and 12 make the playoffs. Okay, so that's, you know, getting closer. But in Major League Baseball, you've got 10 teams that make it out of 30, so exactly a third. But then you think about 4 of those teams only get to play, well, I guess 2 of them technically only get to play one game, and 4 of them theoretically could only play one game. Whereas in all those other sports, even if they're, you know, even if you're the 16th team in the NBA, you're going to play a 5-game series in the playoffs no matter what. So, baseball is it's really tough to have continued excellence. So the fact that the Royals have had 4 straight non-losing seasons is definitely something, you know, to earmark. And like we've talked about before, and then, you know, next year, like you mentioned, there were some bright spots this year that I enjoyed. Yeah, I really liked seeing Chester Cuthbert and him develop into a player that is someone that, you know, can develop. I'm pretty confident now that he can be a consistently, you know, above average major league player. And that's really valuable when you know you've got that in your pocket, especially, you know, with Mike Moustakas coming back from an ACL injury. And we've kind of talked about this just kind of off air discussions of, and we can maybe kind of look a little bit more into this in the off season and talk about it, but how the ACL injuries affect baseball players, because I think it's really known how they affect football players because it's such a common injury there, but baseball not so much. We've just discussed it preliminarily, but we'll get into that deeper into the offseason. Yeah, but there are some interesting things when you talk about how players come back from those. So it will be interesting further to see how Moustakas comes back, and that'll be also one of the things to watch in the offseason. You know, the Royals, Hunter Dozier came up at the end of the season as a September call-up. And, you know, he had some decent decent play. I'm going to look up. I don't know what it is. Let's see what his final line was for the year. I mean, he wasn't, like, blowing the doors off or anything, but he had his moments. He had a 286 or 211 batting average, 286 on base, 263 slugging. So, you know, nothing very special. But, you know, he had an RBI. 21 plate appearance or 19 at bats, 21 plate appearances. So there's not much you can glean from that, but
yeah, you know. He kind of looked the part. I mean, the adjustments that he made, the rebound that he made this year, it puts him back in that discussion, back on the prospect map to where, you know, you can kind of have expectations again. I mean, when we talk about Bubba Starling, we've talked about him for the duration of this podcast more or less, and neither of us really have expectations for him anymore. If he makes it to the majors, it'll be a cool story, but I don't really expect him to do anything. I, you know, 220 and maybe for some power, and I that's maybe best case. I just, you know, don't know. But Hunter Dozier kind of rebounded, came back in, and has shown that, you know, he can demolish AAA pitching. And he was at least ready for a look this year in September. And somebody who's probably going to, you know, he might be one of the last guys to, you know, to make the cut in spring training, or maybe ends up in Omaha and comes up in case of an injury. I mean, we'll see kind of what happens with all three of those. It's kind of interesting because they all are kind of in the same position. Dozier probably. My hot take would be that the Royals no longer really expect Dozier to play regular third base.
Probably not. Judging by how they treated him this year, especially the second half of the year.
They played him a lot at third base in Double A and Triple A, but a lot of that is, they called up Chester Cuthbert. There was an opening, there was opportunity, but they still played him in the outfield plenty, and they played him exclusively in the outfield when he came up to the big leagues. And it's not like Chester Cuthbert played every day. He would have had opportunity to play at third. They never even looked at him there, which kind of tips their hand a little bit to me. And I'll probably be way wrong. He'll probably make the team next year and play only at third and make me look silly, but that's fine. As we'll demonstrate in our second segment today, or whenever you're listening to this, my predictions are pretty, pretty bad sometimes. So, I think Dozier, Cuthbert, Moustakas, we'll see how they shake out. All three might play regularly next year. Maybe one gets traded. Maybe nothing really happens beyond kind of, Moose and Cuthbert switching at third and DH next year. Who knows? Plenty of time to kind of figure that out. And, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know which way the Royals are leaning. They'll probably like to keep all three around if they can, but, playing time and the economics of baseball may make that difficult.
Yeah, and that'll be probably the most interesting thing, as far as I'm concerned, to look at in the offseason, is to see how that all develops. Because, as you mentioned, you've got a couple options here. When you talk about Moustakas and Cuthbert and Dozier, you can fully commit Dozier to right field, and then you keep Cuthbert as insurance / the future after Mike Moustakas, and maybe you rotate those two with DH. Maybe you throw in Hunter Dozier into that as well, possibly allowing some like Paolo Orlando to come out and play some right field. But then there's also, what about Kendrys Morales? The guy just hit 30 home runs. And what was his final, pull up his final RBI count? He was in the 90s.
Like 94 off the top of my head.
Yeah. So
he had opportunities, but he didn't really cash in on them. They didn't really do a lot offensively.
That could be the slogan for the Royals season in retrospect here. Had a lot of opportunities, didn't cash in. 93. So you were one off. But you're looking at, granted he is 33 years old, and let's see when his birthday will be. 30. He just turned 33 in June. He'll turn 34 next season. We've kind of talked about it before, so we don't need to go super into it now. And as putrid as he was to start the season, he nearly had it ended the season with an 800 OPS, 30 home runs, 93 RBIs. Are you really going to let him walk for nothing? In the last two seasons, he's had 52 home runs and 199 RBIs. So he's essentially averaged 25 home runs and 100 RBIs for the Royals, with a 275 batting average, basically, just to give some nice round numbers there. So, then if you bring him back, then how do you handle that situation? And do you possibly trade somebody between the Cuthbert, Dozier, or Moustakas thing? So, we got plenty of time, as you mentioned, to get into all that, but that'll be the number one thing that I'm watching, because I think how the Kendrys Morales situation pans out will be the first domino that affects a lot of how the team is built. We know how the team's going to be built, but the team, how the off season occurs. So,
It's going to be weird, because maybe they meet in the middle and they both want the mutual option.
Could be.
That would be something. I would think he'll probably decline that part. They'll give him a qualifying offer. And I still can't decide if he would take it or not. I guess today I lean that he would take it, but if he wanted to test the market, I think I think his performance the last 2 years probably maybe gives him a better chance of getting a 2-year deal someplace. And maybe that's even in Kansas City. So, yeah, that might be something that they try to resolve fairly quickly just because they want to know, hey, do we need to do the rotating DH that we've talked about for the last 2 years? Or, you know, are we going to continue to have this one guy, plug him in there every day and just go along? And you're right, that will determine to some extent what they're going to do with that other, you know, with the fruits of the third baseman tree and other players, you know, Orlando and Dyson. I mean, they're a little bit redundant. I mean, different skill sets, but, you know, you'd like to maybe be able to see one of those two play more often and go to more of a traditional fourth outfielder thing. Instead, they just kind of alternate them. And so, you know, I think the Royals want to figure that out too. And so that's impacted as well when you kind of look at Morales and the Dozier, Moustakas, Cuthbert group and things like that. So it'll be interesting. It'll be an interesting offseason to see what happens and to see if the Royals are maybe more aggressive than they were last offseason, where they kind of just re-signed some guys and they replaced Ryan Madsen, and that was pretty much it. They just kind of stood pat for the most part and didn't really do a whole lot besides getting Ian Kennedy. And that was kind of their big move. Gordon, but I mean, I still consider him as never really leaving. So I don't know. We'll see if they mix it up a little bit more with the, you know, the lesson of this year in mind, and see if maybe they need to alter their lineup, maybe go for more power, maybe, you know, change up what they do with the rotation. I don't know. It'll be really interesting and rife with you know, intrigue to me to see what they actually do.
It most certainly will. Something to look forward to. It'll be a really exciting off season. You know, last year there was, I think, a lot of things just kind of, you know, obviously we still dissected a lot of the moves they made in the off season, but there was so much euphoria still from winning a world championship that it was just kind of like, oh, okay, you know, well, they essentially get a pass, as any team should, mm-hmm. after winning a world title. So this season, every move is going to be incredibly scrutinized, and it's going to be kind of a, everyone knows about that 2017 window. It's all, you know, that's all the talk radio, all the newspaper, everything. Everyone talks about it. Everyone knows it's there. Even the Royals know it's there. So there's going to be that kind of nervous anticipation in the offseason when talking about the moves they make and how 2017 is going to shake out, especially after this season. So, yeah, it's going to be a really interesting offseason. I am definitely the embodiment of the nervous excitement for next season, and we'll see what happens. You know, I'm cautiously optimistic, and hopefully, you know, I think the Royals are going to be cautiously optimistic that the Royals are going to be back to their 2015 form next year. So with that, I think we'll go to our first break, and then when we come back, the moment you've all been waiting for, Mike and I are going to review the over-unders we had from the beginning of the season. If you remember, we had our season preview show. We made some predictions, did some over-unders. We're going to go. We're going to see how close and in some cases how far away we were from those. So stick with us here, and we'll see you on the other side.
The Kansas City Baseball Vault will be right back after these messages. The Vault.
Hi, this is Ned Baudette for Kelly's Westport Inn. Summertime is here, and that means one thing. Your neighbor's cat sneaks over and craps in your garden. No, of course, I'm just joking. Summer also means my neighbor borrowing your boat trailer and driving it into Smithville Lake, or mosquitoes, or your three-year-old drinking the air conditioner water. Haha, I guess what I'm saying here is that summer means different things to different people. And for 65 years, Kelly's Westport Inn has been a vacation for those summer problems ever since Randall Kelly poured his first frosty draft in 1947. 102 degrees and 99% humidity? Don't worry, Kelly's is air conditioned air-conditioned, and the drinks are as cold as ice. And when the heat breaks, Randall's Rooftop is ready for you to kick back, where you can head downstairs for some of the best live music in town. Summer is different things to different people, but to everyone in Kansas City, Kelly's Westport is your summertime bar. I'm Ned Bodette for Kelly's Westport Inn. We'll leave the taps on for you.
And welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, Baseball Perspectives affiliate. As I mentioned before the break, we are going to go over the over-unders that we had from the beginning of the season. So we will dive right in. We're going to start first with Eric Hosmer. He was a big topic going into the season and had a pretty good 2015. Everyone was thinking he was going to break out in 2016, and you could make the argument that he did, but the over-under on him for home runs, we set it at 18, which his career high was 19 before this season, so 18 seemed pretty reasonable as an over-under, and both of us picked over, and he hit 25, so we're one for one.
25,
all right.
Yeah.
25, not only over, I mean, that's almost 1.5. times the over under. So, you know, he started off just blazing hot to the season.
Yeah.
And then had a couple dips, but nothing like we had, you know, nothing like we had come to expect from Hosmer, where he had those viciously cold streaks and then he would kind of come out of them. And then the first viciously cold streak hit, and it seemed like he never fully recovered from that. He, you know, got back to the point where he would be hitting, but never got back to the just in fuego portion that he was to start the year. So, but his power never really, he had some home run gaps, but for the most part, the power remained for the season and he hit the 25 home runs. He had, did he have exactly 104 RBIs? So 93 RBIs last year, 104 this year. So 197, sorry, for the last 2 years, 18 home runs and 25 home runs this year. So, you know, he's it wasn't quite the breakout year that we were hoping in terms of his power, but at least, mm-hmm. you know, he eclipsed that 20 home run mark, and he's coming into, again, this might be another topic for the offseason that we can dive a little bit more into, but he's coming into his final contract season, if you will. And as a Scott Boras client, there's a lot of interesting trends in terms of home runs and the final year of before a player hits free agency from Scott Boras players. So, Mike, your thoughts on Eric Hosmer's season?
You know, at the All-Star break, he was at 13 home runs. So at that point, it looked like he was on pace to very easily break the over-under. The over-unders, we all we got him from the 50th percentile projections by Baseball Prospectus. And so they actually had him projected for 15, and we bumped it up because that felt pretty conservative. And, you know, it was a pretty easy over for both of us in that sense. 18 being closer, you know, right up there by his career high seemed a lot more challenging to determine, I guess. But yeah, I mean, home runs were generally up all over the place this year. Like Didi Gregorius hit 20 home runs. That's weird. That's probably not normal. And there are many theories. There are, you know, some detractors who say, no, it's just whatever. There's nothing going on. And there are some things that suggest that, well, a lot of things may be different, but one constant is that the baseball is maybe different. I don't know. A lot of different things, a lot of speculation on why. There's even an article, this was on Fangraphs a while back, that was kind of more discussing, okay, yeah, there are more home runs, but a lot of like the middle tier guys, the 12 to 15 home run kind of guys, are the guys who are hitting 20 now. So it's like that's the most affected group, seeing the biggest jumps. And Hosmer kind of fits in that group. Now, he's always, you look at him, he looks like a guy who should be able to hit 30 homers. I mean, he's you know, 6'4", he's a big kid. You know, when he connects, it's an amazing swing. He looks great. It's kind of amazing that he had such good power, and it was his second best season as far as isolated power, the measurement of, you know, basically extra base hits as a ratio above his normal hits, you know. So you just take extra base hits minus his hits and then divide him by the at-bats, I believe, is the actual formula for it. But he did so while having a career-high 58.9 ground ball percentage. I mean, he hits a lot of ground balls. He always has. He's always been more than half the time hitting the ball on the ground. So for him to do that, I mean, he had a significantly high, a 21.4 home run per fly ball rate, which if he continues that, that's pretty elite stuff. But it's always going to be related to this ground ball percentage, and it's like one extreme or the other. So we'll see what happens next year when he comes in. Last year in spring training, a lot of the talk was on, okay, here's how I can hit more home runs. These are some things that I'm thinking about doing to hit more home runs. And he did, but a lot of the same things and you know, like the ground ball trends went even further into the extreme. So, you know, I don't know what that means for next year. It could be crazy. You know, he might hit 30 home runs and still be like a 55% of the time hitting the ball onto the ground. It's who knows. So those are, you know, the general thoughts that I have. You know, he's going into his contract year. We'll see if that leads to some crazy numbers, or maybe it leads to trying too hard to put up crazy numbers. I don't know. But 25 home runs is finally kind of the territory that you felt like Hosmer should have been at all along, especially after his rookie year, we hit 19 in 5 months. It seemed like a foregone conclusion that he was going to be this 25 home run guy every year, and he hadn't been. So maybe we'll see that now while he's in his so-called peak years.
Yep, you know, I wouldn't say overwhelmed in with positivity, but you know, I was happy with this season that especially. It's good to see that power come through and the RBIs. You know, he's capitalizing on the opportunities he had. So that was good. Moving on, our second over-under, Salvador Perez, a true average of 265. 265 was the set, was the 50th percentile from Baseball Prospectus. I went
a little above average on that projection. Yeah. 260 is considered to be an average player. 265, mm-hmm. just a tick above that.
So I went with the over on that. A little bullish on Salvador Perez, I was. And Mike, you went with the under. And he finished at 245. So pretty well under on that.
Significantly under.
And decided he wanted to make me look stupid, I guess. It seems like Salvador Perez, we know the drill at this point with him. So he's going to start the season. He's going to look pretty good. Probably make everyone think, hey, maybe he is a 300 hitter. Maybe he can do this. And then he's going to tail off as the season wears on, as he has more games, as he gets more tired. His home run power is pretty well going to stay where, I mean, his, the last few years since he's, you know, played full seasons. I mean, he's been really pretty consistent. If you look at the last 3 years, 17 home runs, 2014, 21, 2015, 22 this year, 70 RBIs, 2014, 70 in 2015, 64 this year, 260 batting average in 2014, 260 in 2015, 247 this year. So we kind of know the drill, and this year was no change. He's been an all-star all 3 years, actually the last 4 years, and he's had three. The Gold Glove is still yet to be decided. At this point, I think Salvador Perez is in that camp of he may win it just on reputation alone.
Yeah, he may be because
that's
in.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the Gold Glove. That's kind of how those things go for the most part. Unless somebody comes along and kind of and takes it, and I don't know that there's anybody in the American League this year that's just going to take it from him, but it could happen anyway. So yeah, the true average, you know, it's a little disappointing. He had a little bit of a dip in his average, but his, you know, his OPS was still pretty solid at 725. You know, he was hitting for a career high in home runs this year. He tied his career high in doubles, and you know, he's His RBIs were a little bit down, but the offense for the Royals was down overall. I mean, it's kind of par for the course for Salvador Perez, if not a little bit just lower on the batting average side.
I think we know we're starting to see like kind of who he is. You know, the plate discipline's never going to be there. We know that. He's not going to walk. He did match his career high for walks with 22 this year. But he struck out quite a lot more. He'd always been a guy who had that reputation that, okay, he doesn't strike out. He makes a lot of good contact, usually hits the ball hard anywhere in the zone. This year, you know, his career high coming in was 85 strikeouts and 606 plate appearances from 2014. This year, he struck out 119 times and 546 plate appearances, which is a pretty big jump. And we've seen after his first, you know, 3 years or at least three seasons where he spent time with the big league club, you know, 2011, he played the last 2 months, 2012, he missed the first half, 2013, his first real full season. Ever since, his production has kind of gone down to where he looks like he's probably realistically a 260, 290, maybe 425 kind of guy, kind of like last year. Last year's numbers probably look more like what he will be the next few years. His second half this year, I mean, when we talked about this stuff at the All-Star break, his true average was at 290, which was very good. And in the second half, he hit 201, 248 on base, and 357 slugging throughout, you know, after the All-Star break. Just not good at all. And, you know, his first 3 months, he hit 782 OPS, then an 827 OPS. The third month, he had an 859 OPS. And then in the second half, it was 623, 698, and 542. So, I wouldn't say that some of that, you know, I think towards the end of the year, there's probably some fatigue. But when you're looking at, like, the start of the second half, probably shouldn't have a ton of fatigue. And I, you know, what I thought at the beginning of the year, or at least in spring training, was that, you know, he can show those stretches where he has better plate discipline and he lays off the pitches that he can't do anything with. And then I think as he kind of gets into the swing of playing, he ends up chasing more and making contact with stuff that he doesn't need to. And, you know, he really cratered in the second half. But the power is still there. If he's a gold glove catcher who can hit 20 home runs, you can really work with that. And with everything that he gives you in the clubhouse and off the field and things like that, you know, it's not like the Royals are like wringing their hands about him, but, you know, while we kind of expect him to be an all-star, he's maybe not a guy who's performing at that level. So I think the projections next year are probably going to be pretty low on him. Just maybe surprisingly low. There's probably going to be outrage. So be ready for, you know, people to be outraged. That how can you say that about Sal Perez? It's, you know, he's an all-star, he's a gold glover. They're probably going to be around, you know, whatever, you know, what he hit last year, mm-hmm. at 260, 280, 426, which, you know, that's a little below average as far as OPS plus, but again, the power's there, the gold glove defense is there, the arm is there, you know, so you kind of take the good with the bad in that situation, kind of just deal with it. It's he's still a rare breed as far as catchers go. It's just going to be, you know, one of those things where you have to temper expectations. And but I was surprised. I was surprised to see how far that dropped. I thought maybe he'd be at like a 255 true average by the end of the year. I didn't think he'd drop, you know, a whole, you know, 20 points from the projection, which was 45 points from where he was in the middle of July. It was kind of surprising.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting you bring up the strikeouts, because, I mean, you really break it down and you look at it, his on-base percentage was higher than it was last year and, you know, essentially identical to 2014. His OPS was higher than it was in any full season that he's played. And again, tied the career high in home runs, or he had a new career high in home runs, tied his career high in doubles, but the batting average dipped and the strikeouts increased. So it's almost as if basically all his singles, or not all, but like all the difference was just all the an extra 15 singles turned into strikeouts. And that was essentially the difference in his play this year. So kind of interesting when you look at it that way. And see that his, you know, slugging percentage is still up there and the power was still good. So I am in the same camp as you. I'm a little surprised that it dipped as low as it did, but I am happy to see the power remain and to have him now consistently have a few good years of power, and shows that, you know, I mean, it's actually seems like he's actually increasing it a little bit. So as he enters this, he's, you know, kind of in peak years of, especially for a catcher as well, kind of like we talked about with Hosmer, you know, it's not unreasonable to expect him to have it's not a contract year next year like it is for Hosmer, but it's not unreasonable to expect him to have a big home run year either, just based on the fact that, you know, he still has maybe a little bit room to grow in the power department.
Yep. It'll be his age 27 season. And yep. that's the upward slope of those peak years. So
yep.
we'll see how he does there. I think you're right. I think he'll probably be another 20-plus home run guy and, you know, maybe hopefully gets on base a little bit more.
Yeah. And as you said, you know, if he's a gold glove catcher and he can have a 700-plus OPS, give you 20 home runs, and that's what he does, then, you know, you can certainly live with that, because there are a lot of teams that play catchers that are a lot worse, either offensively or defensively. Yep. So, as you said, he is a rare breed, and he's still a special talent, even if he kind of dipped in some areas. Moving on to the next one, Lorenzo Cain, his batting average. So Salvador Perez, we talked about true average. This we're talking about just straight batting average. The 50th percentile projection for Lorenzo Cain was 269. We were both rather confident that he would go over on that, and he did. He hit a 287. So similar to Salvador Perez, we kind of know the drill with him. We kind of know what's happening with Lorenzo Cain. The only thing that is still a slight question is the home runs. It spiked up last year. He hit 16 mm-hmm. for his career high, and he was back down to 9 this year. But, of course, missed a lot of time to injury, played 37 less games than he did the prior year. But in terms of, you know, batting average, he's, you know, he was 301 in 2014, 307 last year, 287 this year. His on-base percentage, 339 2014, 361 last year, 339 this year. Slugging, 412, 477, 408 this year. So, I mean, he's pretty, you know, last year was obviously had a really good season, but, you know, this year I think we see that it's not, you know, after 2014, it was like, okay, was this a fluke? After 2015, it was like, okay, you know, he's done it for two seasons. Can he make this the norm now? And I think it's clear to say that it is. You know, his power numbers might not be as high as we were hoping after last season, but, you know, in terms of who he is as a hitter, I think we know. And that's a really good, very solid hitter. He's going to hit that 280 to 300 range. He's going to give you, you know, 330, 340 on base, 400, you know, it's decent slugging. He's going to be able to kind of stretch some singles into doubles with his speed and so forth. And, you know, maybe couple times he might, you know, go into that 15, 20 home run range. And again, giving you that really good defense in the outfield. So I think I had the season, taking out the injury, pretty much had the season I expected from Lorenzo Cain. I was, you know, a little bit, he started off kind of slow and then picked it up, but I was a little disappointed in that regard. But, you know, overall, looking back, he was about what you thought. So can't be super disappointed with how he played this year, especially given the fact that he was injured and missed so much time.
Yeah, he was banged up in a couple different ways. You know, the thing, it seems like every year the question ends up coming up on Lorenzo Cain, because, you know, a couple of years ago as well, we don't believe he's a 300 hitter, and then he went and did it again. You know, every year he's been in the big leagues, every year that he's taken an at-bat in the big leagues, he's ended up with a BABIP above 300, and significantly in most cases. You know, the last 3 years it's been 380, 347, and 341. Over 2,400 plate appearances in his big league career, it's a 345 BABIP. I think it's safe to say that, you know, as long as he's got legs that, you know, don't limit him, which maybe that's only a couple more years, given, you know, his injury history and his increasing age. But as long as he can put the bat on the ball, he's probably going to be hitting above 300 in the BABIP. So when he puts the ball in play, you should expect it to be over 300. So I think we can probably put that skepticism to rest. Another thing that I noticed when I look at his numbers, in 2014, he hit 301, 339 on base with a 412 slugging. This year, 287, 339 on base and a 408 slugging. Pretty similar, you know, 0.004 point difference in his OPS. The OPS plus in 2014, though, was a 109, so about 9% better than average, roughly. This year is 98. So that kind of shows you where it fits within the context of the rest of the league. And the league was a lot more offensive, offensively friendly. You know, it was a lot more good hitting this year. So it's, kind of interesting to see that sharp of a difference with basically similar numbers. His doubles were higher in 2014. He didn't hit as many home runs in relative to his plate appearances, but, you know, fairly similar years offensively and very dissimilar in relation to the rest of the league. So that's kind of interesting, but I think he can be pretty close to what he did in 2015 with additional power and making enough contact to hit close to 300. So, you know, I think projections will probably still be low on his batting average because they still expect it to regress, but at this point, you can probably bank on him beating whatever batting average projection comes out from whatever source, Baseball Prospectus or Zips or Fangraphs or wherever. He'll probably be better than the 265-ish hitter that they'll expect him to be. I think he's proved that by this point.
Yeah, I agree. And that's a really interesting point, what you bring up about him relative to the league. And I think the first person, if I'm not sure if you had kind of thought about it before, but during the season, it was Hunter Samuels, you know, writer for BP Kansas City. He was the first one to kind of bring it up to me that I recall of just how it didn't really, you know, when you look at the numbers, looked like he was, you know, similar to you, especially, you know, about mid-season or when they kind of hit that hot stretch in August and he was hitting around 300. Looked about the same as it was last year, but then didn't feel the same, and that was why. And that's why a stat like OPS plus is valuable, because then you can see, you know, all seasons are not created equal, even if the statistics themselves are equal, if that makes sense, you know. Mm-hmm. So because there is a context to it, and you talk about, you know, the steroid era, the juice ball era, the current era that we're in, where it seemed like a few years ago we were in another ruled by the pitcher era with, you know, increasing strikeouts and lower run totals, and now the home runs tick back up again. Maybe it's another juice ball era, who knows? But the context is very important. So, you know, it's some of the positive aspects of Lorenzo Cain's season can be tempered a little bit when you look at it that way, but still, it, you know, he was still about league average, and again, considering the injuries he had, you would expect a full season where he was fully healthy for all that time, he would have performed better and probably closer to his past two seasons, especially relative to the league. So hopefully that's what we can count on for next year.
Yeah.
So we'll move on now. We'll get to the pitching staff. First one here, Ian Kennedy. Newcomer here, the big signing of the offseason, the big external signing, if you will, because it probably wasn't bigger than the Alex Gordon signing, but biggest external signing there. The 50th percentile projection from Baseball Prospectus again was 174 innings pitched by Ian Kennedy, and he finished at 195.2. Very solid season for Ian Kennedy, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. He pitched, just the results of how he pitched was a lot better than expected, especially when you look at that June where he was, giving up home runs a lot, and a lot of people were really, really upset with, you know, even having him on the team. And then he had a really good August. We talked so much about how Danny Duffy was great this year. Kennedy in August was even better. So it's really good to see, you know, he came in and did exactly what you expected of him, gave you, you know, nearly 200 innings, you know, was kind of an anchor, a backbone, you know, a big strength in a rotation that really was only working at about 3/5 of its capability. You know, they really struggled with Volquez and with the fifth starter spot. And I guess even Ventura to an extent had a number of different struggles. So Kennedy doing what he did over 200 innings, I think, is exactly what the Royals wanted to see. You know, they projected him at 174. He was on pace to beat that at the All-Star break. He ended up beating it by, you know, over 21 innings. We were both over. I don't think we were expecting much regression. He stayed healthy all year. Solid year from Kennedy. Hopefully he can continue it at least to next year, and then we'll see if he opts out of his deal or not. But, you know, if he does another year like this year, next year, he probably would test the market. But, you know, if he just gives the Royals another 200 innings and takes off, I guess they would say thank you and see who they can get. Not too surprised with Kennedy, especially given where he was at the midway point and, you know, given his career. So that was probably the easiest over we had in this whole contest.
Yep. And, you know, again, the slow start, it almost looked like, man, I remember there was a point when, you know, things were not going well for the Royals where it was like, man, just for a couple of years straight of every move Dayton Moore made turning up blue, if you will, for the Royals, it finally looked like every move he made in the offseason was turning out bad. And then Kennedy's strong second half really kind of bolstered that decision and made you say, okay, it's not quite as bad as it maybe seemed a little bit ago. But
But there was even a week or two before the trade deadline, there were rumors, and I don't know how valid these turned out to be. Maybe it was just a mention in passing that got leaked out, but there was some reporting out there that the Royals were trying to attach him to other trade, you know, candidates that they had, and that, you know, wanting teams to take his contract, which, given how he finished the year, is like, oh, okay, that would have been maybe a mistake. But so maybe there was something to that, but maybe there wasn't. I don't know. But, you know, it was, those reports were plausible enough, given how he had pitched to that point, that it was like, okay, I could see that being a thing that they do if they wanted to bail on the contract by now. And now I think that, you know, if there was some discussion of that, they're very pleased that they didn't explore it beyond whatever rumblings were out there.
Very much so. And, you know, I think he's a guy that I think you're pretty confident now that you can look at him and say, okay, we can count on him to be a solid part of the rotation next year for 2017. I guess you can't, you know, you can pretty confidently say that. But then again, we also said that last year about Edinson Volquez, and that was not the case this year.
True.
So
that's true.
You never know, but Kennedy's a little bit younger, and he, you know, didn't set a career high in innings this year like Volquez did last year, and he also didn't have the playoffs this year like Volquez did last year. So hopefully he doesn't, the same fate does not befell him. But I mean, he had a really good season, and just for a little context, you know, former Cy Young winner in David Price last year, or not last year, but previous winner this year, David Price had a 3.99 ERA. So, you know, Ian Kennedy's 3.68 actually looks pretty good compared to something like that, especially when you think, you know, Kennedy signed for 5 years, $70 million, and David Price signed for 7 years, $217 million. And then last year's Cy Young winner, Dallas Keuchel, he had a, you know, 4.55 ERA this year. So just to put in a little context, that Ian Kennedy actually had a really pretty good season. So, you know, it would have got kind of overshadowed by the fact that he was giving up home runs left and right for that stretch there, and it kind of looked like things were going poorly, and the narrative was out on him. It was defined, and unfortunately, you know, as many fan bases do, the Royals fan base was a tough time letting go of those, even when they can see the results with their own eyes. So either way, definitely pleased with what Kennedy gave you, and even if he wasn't 3.68, even if he was more in the closer to the four or slightly above four ERA range as a pitcher, that's still not bad. That's still the going rate for that kind of pitcher that can give you 190, 200 innings and a four ERA. I mean, that is what they cost. That's just the reality of baseball economics right now. So if that's what he gives you next year, it will, you know, on paper, it will seem worse, but you know, that's what he should be getting essentially.
Yeah. I mean, if he makes 32, 33 starts, that's six innings per start. It's, you know, if you get an average pitcher to give you six innings a start, that has a ton of value. I mean, that's, it's nothing flashy, but it's valuable. So Kennedy, if he can exceed that being better than average, then yeah, that's just gravy is what it turns out to be. And last year, that was the case.
Yes. And so moving on to our final over under, sticking with pitching.
Yeah.
Yordano Ventura. So the over under on him was 168 innings pitched. Mike, you were confident he would go over. I was very confident that he would definitely surpass it. And we can kind of snowball this into our bold prediction review as well, simply because mine is connected, as I believe my bold prediction was not only would Yordano Ventura get Cy Young votes, but that he would finish third in the Cy Young voting, I believe is what I said. I don't know if I mentioned that on the show, but I put it in the baseball prospectus, the BP Kansas City prediction article, I think. So,
yeah, I have it down that you said he would get votes, which is at least a little more scaled back, which is.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can finish 25th and get votes, but put it this way, we don't have to hold. We were talking about Salvador Perez and Gold Gloves. Now, he could win his fourth consecutive. We know we'll wait and see on that. But we don't need to hold our breath on whether or not Yordano Ventura gets himself any Cy Young votes. He, along with his career high in innings pitched, clearly getting the over on the 168 innings pitched. He had 186 of those he had pitched. He also set a career high for ERA. He set a career high for home runs. He set a career high for walks. So, you know, not exactly, and hits as well, if we're going to just keep going down the line. But, you know, not exactly the most exemplary season for a guy that you really thought was ready to take that step. You know, last year he started out slow. Maybe the pressure of being an opening day starter got to him. The pressure of, you know, after the game six in 2014 of the World Series where he did so well, all that maybe went to his head, got to him a little bit. He had the off the field, well, not off the field, but the non-baseball on the field issues, getting into fights and such, and settled down in the second half, had a really good second half last year. Thought that this year he was going to be primed to turn the corner. All the reviews were raving out of spring training. He looked really good, looked poised, looked ready to go, and then he just shit the bed. I don't really know what else to say about that, but that's where it was. So yeah, he got the innings in. You know, he set the set his career high with that, and that's about all that you can really say. I mean, he made all his starts. I mean, 32. You know, he had a brief moment or two during the season where you thought, okay, he's kind of settling in. I mean, if you look into his
July splits, and August kind of spot in the same,
yeah, you know,
same
he He did pretty well in August, just like everyone was doing well. He had a 2.55 ERA in 35 innings pitched in August, so by far his best month. And that was kind of it. You know, his overall, I mean, his strikeouts were down. His walks were up. His walks per nine were the highest of his career. His strikeouts per nine were the lowest of his career if you take out his brief three-game appearances in 2013. So, I mean, it was just – it was an unfortunate year for Yordano Ventura. And, again, you saw the bright spots. So you got to hope the Royals can figure something out. I think a lot of the – you started to see and hear a lot of people talking about it this year. A lot of the issues with him were his mechanics were just not – repeating very well, so he wasn't, you know, his arm slot would change and it would cause his pitches to act differently, and next thing you know, games get out of hand and he didn't seem like he was dealing with it very well. So, you know, the Royals need to figure out something, because the talent is there. We've seen it multiple times. We know it's there. We know it can happen. They need to get him to be able to harness it and, you know, get to the point where, you know, Danny Duffy is, to where Duffy had that talent and he had his issues as well, and he's kind of worked through them, and he's poised to have a big year next year. So, you know, hopefully Ventura can do the same.
Yeah, he showed flashes, but he did struggle with the command for pretty much all of this season, and especially early he was walking so many guys. You know, I follow him on Instagram, and some of the things towards the, you know, in August and September, I think maybe it's mostly September, he was posting photos of himself, and the captions were talking about mechanics, and like it was almost like he was doing a self-affirmation of good mechanics. It was like, good mechanics will get us through, and things like that, like just to reinforce for himself what he needs to do, you know, because a guy like him who has that curveball and a good changeup and that fastball, he really should be striking out a lot more guys, and, you know, he just doesn't. And maybe that is something that he needs to, you know, work on and adjust to in this off season. He'll get it to click and maybe adjust from other adjustments. So I don't know. A 4.45 ERA, which isn't, you know, terrible. It's just not good. And if he's going to be a guy who they expect to give him, you know, 180 to 200 innings next year, you would want it to be better than that. Now, again, like I said with Kennedy, you know, if he's in that range, it still has some value, and there's still a lot of upside any given day that he takes the mound. But, you know, it's consistency. You got to see consistency. And at this point, he hasn't shown it. And the Royals, I think, they should feel like if he starts to show that consistency, well, then, hey, he can be a force. It's just like Danny Duffy. He got consistent. He worked on his mechanics. He got his command in line, and he had a fantastic season as a result. And maybe they'll take some of that same patience and approach and what have you that worked with Duffy, and maybe it'll work with Ventura this off season, and he'll come back, and those two can be a nice lefty righty 1-2 punch. That's going to be the hope. And maybe they both turn the same corner and they're both getting Cy Young votes next year. Maybe we can make bold predictions about them again next season. But yeah.
Lord knows I love to repeat my bold predictions, as Kyle Zimmer will tell you.
Sean Manaea did pitch in the majors this year, though.
That's a good point. It's a very good point, Mike. Very good point.
Yeah. Kyle Zimmer.
Kyle Zimmer maybe didn't even did he throw a pitch? I don't know. He had to throw a pitch because he injured himself. But then I think he threw the one,
but he didn't.
And then he injured, and then now he is. But hey, the flavor of the week in the sports surgery world is this new thoracic outlet syndrome. Hoche ever had it. Zimmer has had it. Hopefully.
Dylan G just had it too.
Dylan G just had it. Chris Young had it a few years ago. Yeah. You know, hopefully it's something that truly is what's bothering him, and he can finally realize his potential. But similar to the Cy Young votes, I am not holding my breath. So
that's fair.
we can roll that in. Mike, why don't you give us a rundown of your bold prediction and how that turned out?
Well, I mean, one of them was that Dillon G was going to be a steal this year. And he, you know, he pitched okay, but he didn't pitch very well. Gave him 125 innings, 89-37 strikeout to walk ratio, and a 4.68 ERA. You know, not great, but he did pitch pretty well in August when they really needed a fifth starter to step up, and he fulfilled that role. But, you know, he faded towards the end of the year. And actually, he ended up having some blood clots, which was kind of scary. Everything worked out well, but then it did lead to that thoracic outlet syndrome surgery, which we will see what happens next year. But I would say I was off on that prediction. I think in my notes, I have that he would be the third best starter, which no, he wasn't. Though in some sense there, that was kind of a low bar to climb over, because the fifth starter generally was bad and Volquez was not very good. And, but you know, I was off on that one. You know, not too bad. My really bold prediction, or at least not super bold, it was bold-ish, more interesting bold prediction, I guess, was that I thought Kelvin Herrera was going to have a better season than Wade Davis. And Davis, you know, he had two DL stints, which hampered a lot of that. And then once he came back from the second one, he kind of, he didn't struggle, but the Royals seemed more willing to hide him in a sense. I don't know if that was they just didn't want to pitch him consecutively that often or what. Maybe they just wanted to lighten the load and kind of, you know, could read the tea leaves and know that they weren't really in good shape to make the playoffs and they still have to think of next year. For a while, Herrera looked like he was going to be able to meet that prediction, but he faded too. I think, you know, maybe he hit a wall after two seasons of an extra month of baseball. You know, he went all out throughout 2016. He did, you know, have a much more dominant season, an 86-12 strikeout to walk ratio and a 0.96 whip, which is pretty strong. Davis ended up with a 1.87 ERA, 1.13 whip, 47-16 strikeout to walk ratio. So 3-1, still pretty good. 210 batting average against Herrera, 72 innings pitched, 2.75 ERA, which is really close to what he did last year. Again, that 86-12 strikeout to walk ratio, 0.96 whip, and a 214 batting average against. So I guess if you looked at quantity of good outings, maybe that qualifies, but overall by the rates, you know, he did give up a fair amount of runs. Some of that skewed by the last, you know, week and a half of the season where he gave up, I think he gave up like multiple runs in like three straight innings or three straight appearances or maybe three out of four or something like that to really kind of drag down the overall numbers. But, you know, still both quality good, you know, quality good. That's nice and redundant.
Quality good, yes.
Quality good. Double plus good seasons.
Double greats.
But, yeah, I don't think I can claim that one as a win either. Closer than the Dillon G one, I would say, but definitely not
yes,
a win.
Yes, he did have an 8.18 ERA in September. So you could say that clouded the numbers a little bit.
Yeah, that's you know, I think he just kind of got gassed. Ironically,
it happens.
I guess
it does. Ironically, heyo.
They do call him Gas Man.
They do. The for about the first half of the season, though, it actually looked like that was going to be a pretty solid prediction on your part. Turned out that it was, again, it was kind of a weird year for the bullpen. A lot of shuffling, a lot of injuries. You know, I think a lot of the, a lot of how good they've been performing the past couple of years has been just their consistency, because with, you know, taking out Greg Holland, with the exception of losing Greg Holland at the end, near the end of last year, you know, they were pretty consistent in their bullpen makeup. So, having all that shuffling around this year, who knows how much of an effect that actually had. But still a really good season for Kelvin Herrera. So We'll wrap up with one final thought, Mike. As the season is now over, what are your thoughts on the Royals in 2016? A historical season for them the first ever 500 season. So what are your thoughts to wrap up the year?
Well, I mean, high hopes to start out. And then the really bad July was really tough. They did have that point where they were 51 and 58, and everybody had pretty much packed it in at that point. And then they had that great August, and everybody kind of bought back in. They did make it interesting. Ultimately, it was just too many injuries, too much fading back into normalcy, I suppose, if I want to say it differently than regression to the mean. You know, dissatisfied, but not despondent, I guess is a way to put it.
Fair enough. You know, I feel similarly. You know, I think July was very disconcerting to see that happen. But, you know, considering we kind of tried to keep bringing this up throughout the season, but considering everything they went through, you know, we obviously knew at the end of from the end of last season that Greg Holland wasn't going to be here all year. So, you know, him, Rose not having him anymore, you know, Wade Davis missing a lot of time, Joaquin Soria having his struggles, Luke Hochaver missing a lot of time, you know, all the pitching staff struggles, Lorenzo Cain injury, Alex Gordon injury, Mike Moustakas out for the year, all of these things and more coupled together to really, you know, it could have just been a disaster of a season. It looked like it, like you said, it looked like it was heading that way at the 51 and 58 mark, and they were just like, oh man, here we go again. But, you know, they showed that when healthy, when they compete, they're still a top tier team in this league. You know, unfortunately, they didn't have enough health, and that's so often, that's one of the things they've been blessed with the last couple of years that have allowed their success. You know, very few. Yeah. They had the one big injury to Eric Hosmer in 2014, but he came back for the playoffs. And they had the one big injury to Alex Gordon in 2015, but he came back for the playoffs. And those, you know, when it's just the, if it's just the one, you can handle it. You know, if it was just Wade Davis, you could probably handle it. If it was just Luke Hochaver, if it was just Moose, or if it was just Gordon. But when all these things happen essentially at the same time, and when you've got an outfield, you know, of where you've got Dyson, Orlando, and Gordon as your outfield, a hobbled Alex Gordon, you know, that's like, man, this is not quite how we envision things. And you've got to start Chester Cuthbert for the majority of the year at third base. And then, you know, you eventually bring up Raul Mondesi to play second base. I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot of, they faced a lot of adversity this year, and they came through and still were able to finish the season 500. So yeah, you put it perfectly, as you so often do, the not despondent, disappointed, but not despondent. So, you know, I think that's a good way to put it. I think that's a good way to leave it for the season, but we are not leaving you for the season. We of course will be back all off season, as we have been every off season since we've done the show. We'll have plenty to talk about. You know, we'll keep up to date, obviously, with you all on the playoffs. I don't know if I'll watch it as I definitely won't watch it as intently as I have the last couple of years. I'm sure I'll in passing watch a game or two, and obviously we'll keep up with it. But you know, there's going to be plenty to talk about. Lots of possible contract talk. You know, I think the Royals, however fruitful it will be, we'll make an effort to have both Danny Duffy and Eric Hosmer under a long-term contract by the beginning of next season. Who knows if that's actually what will happen? Duffy, I think, is a reasonable bet. Hosmer, I think, is reasonable not to see it happen.
Yeah,
but that's, you know, and you know, it'll be interesting to see if the Royals increase the payroll at all. If they decrease it, who knows? So there'll be plenty of stuff to talk about. We'll be here to talk about it with y'all, and we have a couple special things planned for the summer that we hope to do throughout
the winter.
Through the winter, the off season. Yes, wishful thinking through the off season. That was kind of back in the like school mode of thinking. Off time must be
off
summer.
Off season is summer. Yeah.
But through the winter, yes. So to keep you warm through the winter, we'll have plenty of good content here on the Kansas City Baseball Vault. Hot stove season, indeed. And we will be cooking up plenty of shows for you. You like that? You like that? That was pretty good.
I don't know if I like that or not, but I'll be proud of that one.
So with that, we'll leave you on this evening or afternoon or morning or whenever you're listening to the show. So it's been, you know, a solid golf clap of a season for the Royals. Another one in the books, 81 wins. Can't complain too much, but you can complain a little bit. So, you know, that's how it goes sometimes. Them's the breaks. Royals can hopefully have an extra month to rest up, to heal up, and get ready for 2017 season. There's going to be heaps of pressure on them, and we're going to have a long, long time of offseason to talk about it. So stick with us. We'll be back next week to talk about more Royals baseball, or more Royals organization, I guess. Not actually baseball to talk about this time, but we will certainly be back, and we'll be with you all season. So stick with us, and I'm sure we'll have some watch parties and stuff of different events throughout the offseason, and especially as we get close to spring training. At our favorite haunt of Kelly's, as you should all frequent, because we couldn't do it without them, just like we couldn't do it without you. So thank you all so much for listening. We greatly appreciate it. We will see you next time. And as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to kansascitybaseballvault@gmail.com.